You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. And now, what you have all been waiting for, hearing from Christina Rizga and Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Christina Rizga, education correspondent at Mother Jones and author of the book Mission High. It is my pleasure to welcome and introduce Nicole Hannah-Jones, one of the greatest and most powerful voices of my generation, to the Bay Area. As many of us in this audience know, Nicole has dedicated her professional life to investigating policies that have created and continue to maintain racial segregation in our neighborhoods and our schools. Her 2014 ProPublica investigation showed us how our schools today are more segregated by race and class than they were shortly after Brown v. Board of Education was passed, which declared segregated schools unconstitutional. And I remember very vividly when Nicole's story came out, how it pushed through the issue of segregation and economic inequality into mainstream conversations, and it changed journalism, and it changed conversations about school reforms. In her This American Life story about Michael Brown's high school in 2015, Nicole took to task then Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and criticized the Obama administration for not paying enough attention to school integration, a policy that we know, when implemented well, works better than any other in cutting the achievement gap, reducing racial disparities and income inequality. Shortly after that story, Secretary John King Jr. announced giving out $120 million for voluntary integration programs. This year, Nicole won the National Magazine Award for her moving and very personal New York Times Magazine story, Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City, and we'll definitely be talking about that. Nicole also helped found the Ida B. Wells Society, which works to bring more investigative reporters of color into our newsrooms. And she's writing a book about school segregation titled The Problem We All Live With. I personally have learned so much from Nicole's journalism, the historic context that she brings to every single story she writes, and her leadership and her courage. And it is such an honor for me to be able to talk to Nicole today about what's going on in our country and what role public schools play in that. But before we dig in on all of it, please help me give Nicole a welcoming round of applause. So I thought I would start with Charlottesville because so many Americans, I think, this week are still trying to make sense of it all and trying to figure out what all of it means, you know, for the future of our country. Emboldened by Trump, white supremacists are coming, you know, they're on national tour and they're coming to San Francisco and Berkeley this weekend. And since that horrifying day on August 12, much of the outrage has been focused on condemning the violence and the moral bankruptcy of President Trump for, you know, placing equal blame on so-called, quote-unquote, many sides. But in the midst of this huge push to reject violence, you raised some really powerful points on Twitter, because you're supposed to work on a draft, but you you posted mini essays on Twitter, and you said, we shouldn't be lulled by
the president. Okay. Yeah. Go straight to Twitter.
We shouldn't be lulled by people coming out against Charlottesville violence. Condemning killing is the easiest thing. It does not take courage. It doesn't mean you support equality and civil rights. And then you argued that the most harmful forms of racism are actually spread in much more sinister ways than the neo-Nazi and KKK groups. Can you tell us a little bit more about that point?
Yeah, I think I mean, clearly, we should condemn what happened in Charlottesville. But I think like I said in the tweet, that is the easiest thing to do. What is hard is the segregation and the inequality that we all sustain in our communities every day. So I live in New York City, probably one of the most liberal, progressive cities in the world. And it's the third most segregated residentially and has the most segregated large school system in the country. So I just don't get super excited when people can say that it's wrong to like hold torches and, you know, say the Jews will not replace us. Like, obviously, I think everyone can feel good about that, and everyone can feel like they're on the right side of justice when they do that. And then, you know, they go back home and fight to keep their daughters and their sons out of schools like my daughter goes to, or they fight to keep affordable housing out of their communities. They fight against affirmative action. They fight against justice programs. And I'm not talking about Southerners in red states. I'm not talking about conservatives. I'm talking about progressive people. And most of my work is actually just trying to get progressive people to live their values. I'm not even dealing with people who don't actually agree with the things that I write about.
Yeah, and that's what you spent your career documenting, is just like all these different systems, you know, this sort of invisible machinery through which all of this happens. And I remember in your 2014 ProPublica story, Segregation Now, one of the most powerful points that really stayed with me for a long time and informed a lot of journalism that I was doing. You were making this point that when Brown v. Board was passed, Justice Warren wasn't arguing for it and saying that, you know, we need to have integration because that's the only way we can have equitable resources for these schools, even though that's true and that comes as a result of that. And as you've, you know, have said many times in your work, you know, we've never in our history have had a situation where Black, Latino, Native American students were separated from white students and getting the same resources. It's never happened, so that's a big part of it. But you were saying that Justice Warren was making, it hinged on another idea about the purpose of public education that I think, you know, has slowly faded away. Can you remind us of that?
Yeah, so it's interesting because most people, I mean, how many people here have ever read the Brown decision? So that's pretty common. And of course, it was the most important Supreme Court decision of the 20th century, if not ever. But most people have never actually read the decision. And most people think the decision was about unequal resources, and it actually wasn't. And so if you read the decision, it doesn't even mention resources at all. And I think our either intentional or uninformed understanding of Brown is that Brown was about equal resources. And so therefore, as schools have resegregated, as long as we can provide equal resources, it's not really a problem. But what Brown was really about was citizenship and caste. And it was understanding that what Chief Justice Warren says is that education is probably the most important function of government, and that a child who's deprived of a quality education has very little chance of succeeding in life, but also of reaching their full citizenship in this country. And Brown was about undoing caste. It was about understanding that there was a stigma and that segregation was not a benign segregation. The segregation was designed to stigmatize Black Americans. It was designed to keep Black Americans in second-class citizenship. And integration was really about Black children getting their full citizenship and then being able to become fully American as adults. We have lost sight of that, clearly. I think we don't talk about public education in that way. We talk about public education in terms of how are test scores at a school? What's the curriculum? Brown doesn't mention test scores. Brown doesn't mention an achievement gap. Brown is unconcerned with those things. Not that they're not important, but I think, again, we have come to think that if we just can test these schools to death, if we can maintain segregated, high-poverty schools, and as long as we're implementing some kind of accountability measures, that it's okay. But that doesn't actually deal with the fundamental issue, which is that the separation of marginalized minorities deprives them of the ability to be full citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we have, well, that in, we're fundamentally racist country, probably. But those, that is what has allowed us then to, for the last 30 years, really, stop talking about integration as a necessity at all, and instead to sustain segregated schools and pretend as if we can make them equal.
And it's really concerning that it seems like across the political spectrum, the purpose of public education is only discussed in terms of training skilled workforce for the global economy. And this other, much more important goal is hardly ever mentioned.
Yeah, I think in general, I mean, we've seen this with a lot of our public institution, is this need to marketize and monetize. Mm-hmm. Public education, by its very definition, is a socialist institution. It is everyone pays in for everyone to get something for free. And we all are supposed to get the same thing. But now we've introduced these market-based principles, and education is about competition and how can I vie to get my child into the best school. And we should have choice. But as we know, in a system of capitalism, choice means there will be winners and there will be losers. And as we know, in a racialized system of capitalism, who the losers will almost always be. And so we have been seduced by this notion of choice because it makes sense, right? But it actually doesn't. I mean, if you're really understanding that public education was not about, well, let me rephrase. The very best instincts of public education are not about competition, but about ensuring that every child, no matter where they come from, gets a basic education that will prepare them to become citizens. Of course, that's never actually been true. And part of what my book is arguing, it's interesting when we say, what is the purpose of public education? What my book is arguing is that in this country, public education has been designed to solidify caste. And that from the founding of common schools in this country, when black children were prevented, even in the North, from attending public schools that their own parents, taxpayers, or tax dollars were funding, to when once they were finally allowed into public schools, they were going to school for half a day when white children got a full day. Less money was spent on black children, sometimes 10 times less money. So I also think that public education was designed to produce exactly what it has, which is to train white children to take the most advantaged jobs and to train black children for their lot in life, which was largely to be the servant class.
And you talk a lot about this in this essay that you wrote when Betsy DeVos was going through the confirmation hearings. You wrote an essay called, you know, Have We Lost Sight of the Promise of Public Schools? And you highlighted this massive outpouring of support for traditional public schools, and people were posting photos of doing things in public schools and sharing moving stories about their experiences in public schools and how it saved them and it helped them. But you pointed out that, you know, this pride was obscuring the larger truth that we began moving away from the public in public education a long time ago, way before Betsy DeVos. When do you think that, what are some signs of that that you see, you know, in addition to choice and competition?
So let me first start by saying, I mean, I all of my work is about public schools, and I am a huge critic of the way that public schools have damaged and disadvantaged, particularly black and Latino children. At the same time, I am a believer in public schools, and I believe that fundamentally, if we ever actually live up to the promise of these schools, that they do have the potential to be a great equalizer, that for most children, they are never going to be able to afford to go to a private school, and we don't want that, actually. I believe in a common good. So I think that's important. But at the same time, what the choice movement has thrived upon is this vast inequality in our schools. So when you have poor black and Latino neighborhoods where the only option that a parent has is a public school that is failing their kids, and I don't think all schools with low test scores are failing schools, but I have spent a lot of time in low-income schools that actually are failing their kids. And those schools know that those kids are going to come no matter what because they don't have an option. Mm-hmm. And then you have a charter company that will come in, and they may not be producing better results, but at least the parent feels like I have a choice. Like, you're sending me glossy brochures in the mail. You're courting me. You're wanting me to come in. And so even if that school isn't providing a better education, for parents who have no choice and their only choice is a shitty neighborhood school, This is what our inability to deal with the inequality in public schools has wrought, I think. We started walking away. I mean, you know, everything goes back to race in this country. So we started walking away from a firm belief in public schools right after Brown v. Board. And that is when, so in this country, and I talk about this in that piece, there was large support for public institutions among white Americans when there was legal segregation, where Black Americans largely did not have access to those public institutions. Once you had Brown v. Board and then the 1964 Civil Rights Act, you start to see a very steep decline in public support among white Americans for public institutions, everything from hospitals to parks to schools. And so right after Brown, you had Southern states that actually were willing to shut down public education in order to avoid a single Black child from entering a school with a white child. And that's where you first start to see vouchers. So the voucher movement, its forebear is resistance to Brown, where states like Alabama, states like Virginia, other Southern states start to close down public schools and offer white parents tuition vouchers to pay for private schools. The choice movement, right? Freedom of choice was an anti-integration program. The tests to get into schools that a lot of progressive communities love now, right? To get into magnet schools, to get into your best schools. Those are screen schools. Those screens come out of resistance to Brown. So I think we can see, you start to see as soon as Black children are starting to get access to white schools is when you start to see white support for public schools decline.
You know, I think, I was thinking how one positive development since Charlottesville, we always talk a lot about history, is you know, how much time people have been spending actually talking about history in the last week. And debating, you know, history of slavery, history of civil war, who deserves to be honored in public spaces. And this just made me think a lot about how history is taught in the United States and how many gaps there are. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, I know that in college you majored in history and African American studies, and I majored in history too. But what I wonder, how was history of race, civil rights, Reconstruction, Jim Crow taught in your schooling experience? What was that like?
Yeah, this is interesting. So there were a bunch of us Black writers. One, I'm kind of old now, so I legit can't remember back that far. I have not been in high school for a long time. But we were having a discussion because the AP did a story about how close to a majority of white Americans think the Civil War was fought over states' rights and not slavery. And we were trying to remember, like, what were we taught about the Civil War in high school? And I remember also being taught that. And I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in the Midwest. And I think that was extremely common, that I remember trying to actually discover, like, what was slavery about? I mean, what was the Civil War about? Because I knew, like, it ended slavery. So I'm like, if it wasn't about slavery, then why did it end slavery? But having like a really hard time, even reading text, it was also murky. Like, none of the text would just explicitly come out and say what slavery is about. So I'm pretty sure, I mean, you didn't learn a lot of clearly about the role that Black people have played in this country at all. So, I mean, basically you learned about slavery because the Civil War ended it. That was it. And then you go to Martin Luther King, right? And you see a couple pictures of folks getting mustard dumped on their heads, and you think that that was the extent of the civil rights movement. You're not learning about lynchings. You're not learning about the brutality of it. And then, you know, Dr. King gives his speech, and even though he gets assassinated somehow, you know, our country was over racism. And that was literally, I mean, it. And I think that's largely how it is still taught today. I mean, in general, we know Americans don't know very much about history at all. And I'm always astounded, like when I travel abroad or when I talk to people who are born in other countries, like they actually know a lot about like the history of their country, and we know very, very little. So I think that's a problem. But I think particularly when it comes to race and understanding, you know, it shouldn't even be a debate about Confederate monuments. Like, it's actually ludicrous. But because we don't know this true history, then we're still like having these debates right now. And that's been extremely detrimental. It's why I spend so much time in the past in all of my stories. Usually about half of my stories are take place in the past, because I feel like I have to build up the understanding and the knowledge of this history before people can even understand why it's such a problem now. The story of Black people in this country is like the most inconvenient narrative, if right. I mean, we just like, when you want to learn, it's hard to like talk about how exceptional we are. We were not a democracy for millions of people in this country, literally until 1968, when the last of the civil rights legislation was passed. You can't talk about George Washington without having to talk about that he enslaved and ran a forced labor camp, right? Thomas Jefferson, like all of these presidents. I remember I went to now I'm gonna like talk too much. I went to the Liberty Bell. Have you guys ever been to Liberty Bell? First of all, it's like this big. I just went for the first time a couple years ago and I couldn't believe how small it was. Like in my head, it was like, I was like, oh, this is the model? And they're like, no, that's it. but when you go to the Liberty Bell, you now have to go through like this installation on slavery, which shocked me. But it also was like shocked the white folks in line. Some of them were like really pissed because they were in Philadelphia to like hear about the glory of like, you know, America and, you know, the fact that, well, we enslaved like lots of people. It's kind of just inconvenient to the story they wanted to tell themselves. But there was no other way to get through there, which I actually thought was like really smart and lovely, because you're coming to see this Liberty Bell. It's about liberty, and you're having to like go through an installation about all of these people in this country who were deprived of liberty. So I think it is hard. We don't want to deal with this history. That's why we have to say that slavery was about states' rights. And I'm always like, yeah, the state's right to own slaves. Like, that's what it was about. We have to tell ourselves that, you know, segregation has been illegal in this country since 1954. So people always say, like, why are you calling these schools segregated? No one's forcing Black kids to go to segregated schools anymore. We don't want to talk about that. Some places were still fighting desegregation orders until, like, the 1990s. When I wrote about Michael Brown's school system, St. Louis was like fighting desegregation until the 1990s. So when you don't understand that history, then when you're trying to talk about remedies, when you're trying to talk about how do we make things more equal, people want to reject that because they're like, everyone has the same rights. Everyone, if you work hard, anyone can accomplish anything. And we know that's not true. But it is our lack of ability to deal with our past, to acknowledge the atrocities of what we've done and our ongoing privilege. I mean, this is the thing, is white Americans would never have to do anything discriminatory their whole lives, but they've already benefited from a system that has produced wealth, that has privileged them in schools, that has privileged them in employment. And so it's not even necessarily about whether people have racial animus or not, but it is about, if you want equality in a country that was fundamentally unfair, you actually have to give something up. And that's where everyone's like, you know, it's all good to like believe in equality till someone's like, you got to send your kid to that school over there. And then all of a sudden, most liberal folks don't really care much about equality at all.
Yeah, that's, and I struggle with this. I hear this a lot, especially in immigrant communities. The response sometimes to me is, I'm not even connected in any way to the South or slavery, and I don't understand why I have to be involved in these fights. And I talk to so many Americans who went to elite schools and private schools, and you know, they don't really when I try to talk to them about systemic racism, you know, it's sort of glaze over. And I think there's just, it's such a, and me too, as an immigrant, you know, who came here after high school, it took a long time to kind of realize, like, it's such an invisible machinery, such an invisible kind of hidden machinery that continues to push opportunity, wealth, safety, to white Americans. And without history, without understanding that, just I don't see how you can reduce it. And so most people sort of assume, well, it's just about, you know, your personal views, and you know, I don't hold those views, so I'm fine. Why do I have to participate in these fights? And it's just really hard to see that invisible machinery and all the mechanisms. And so I really hope that everyone, for me personally, it's been really helpful to read everything you wrote, everything that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote. And, you know, even though I went to high school in Latvia, I went to another high school, a mission high school, and took some of the best history and English classes I've ever had. And that's where I learned, you know, everything I learned, civil rights, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, I'm very grateful for that. But I really hope it begins to change in this country.
Can I address the immigrant thing real quick?
What's that?
Could I address the immigrant?
Yeah, please.
So this is where history matters, right? So one, I was tweeting about this week too, because we have to disabuse ourselves of this notion that slavery was a Southern institution. Slavery was an American institution. Slavery, one, the North, many particularly East Coast states were slave states initially, but also the entire economy of the United States was based on slavery. And this is part of our inability to do with our history is we have to like minimize the institutional slavery. But what we actually know is that banking systems were set up around slavery, entire industry in the North, the Industrial Revolution is only possible because black folks are down south producing the cheapest cotton in the world. And are able to send that up north. And so that is what actually fuels the Industrial Revolution. We know that the net worth of black bodies was worth more than every other American commodity combined. So slavery was the fundamental driver of the American economy. And so all of the wealth that was produced in this country can tie, about two-thirds of it can be tied back to slavery. I mean, two-thirds of the millionaires in this country at the time were in the South. They were slaveholders. South Carolina fires the first shot in the Civil War because almost all of its wealth is tied to slavery. So I think if you are in this country, it doesn't matter when you came here, whatever wealth this country has was literally produced on the backs of African people. But the second thing is, our immigration policy until 1965 had quotas on people of color. So countries, Asian countries, African countries, Caribbean countries, there were quotas on the number of people of color who could be admitted into this country as immigrants. The civil rights movement that black folks did is the reason why we can have so many immigrants from Asia, from parts of Africa, and from the Caribbean. And so when folks come and want to distance themselves from black Americans, I wish that they understood this history, that it was the literal violent and deadly sacrifice of black people in this country who fought not just for their own freedom, but for the freedom of people of color all over the world to be able to come to what, as much as our democracy has been perfected, has been on the backs of black folks. So I think that history is also important to acknowledge.
Yeah, and I, you know, Brown v. Board and civil rights movement also inspired Asian American parents here in San Francisco in 1974 to win the lawsuit to provide extra resources for students who are learning English. Until then, you know, the idea was like everyone gets the same funding, and they said no, actually, if students have greater needs, that they need to get more money. And then a few years later, the same civil rights were extended to 3.7 million students with disabilities, and that again comes, you know, directly from the civil rights movement and Brown v. Board. I wanted to move and talk a little bit about your really powerful and moving personal essay about finding a school for Nadja in a segregated city. And you know, it was such a beautiful essay, and I think there was just such radical honesty about all the challenging and complex decisions that you went through to decide where to send her to school. And, you know, as you say, you spent your career kind of documenting about the harms of segregated schools, and yet, you know, when it came to your own daughter, you chose one, and you do say that it's a high-functioning school, but it does have low test scores and it is segregated. So why did you make that decision?
Yeah, so I should first say that I don't think it is on Black parents, and particularly middle-class Black parents, to have to solve the problem of segregation. That is fundamentally unfair. We didn't cause it. And for most of us, they're like myself and my husband, first-generation college students, first-generation to actually be middle class. The grip on the middle class for us is very tenuous. What the data shows is that our children are actually the most likely to fall back down into poverty. So our ability to try to confer advantage on our children is much more critical, because the only advantage we have is that, right? Mm-hmm. Black folks don't have wealth. Our family, my family certainly has no wealth, that sort of thing. But so let me just state this explicitly. White folks have to fix segregation. Like, it is white people's job to fix segregation. If it's up to Black folks, there would not be segregation. Let's be clear. So,
you're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
But with that said, so I've been writing about school segregation since my very first job as a journalist in 2003. My very first job was to cover the Durham Public Schools in North Carolina. And it was a majority Black district that had been devastated by white flight after desegregation. And it was right after No Child Left Behind. And I was watching, you know, as a brand new reporter, the devastating effects that No Child Left Behind was having on these schools, where 99% of the kids were poor, 99% of the kids were Black and Latino. And they were somehow expected to get the exact same test scores as a school that had 10% poverty. And so I was writing about segregation right away, and I remember one of my colleagues who covered state education and lived in Durham and cared really, really about these kids, and then it was time for her kid to start school. And then she was like, I can't put my kid in my neighborhood school. And for her, she said it was because the schools were poor. The children were poor in the school, which to me, one, somehow that doesn't really make it better, right? I don't want my kid around poor kids, but we also know that we use poor to talk about race, right? And I would see that over and over in my career, where you would see these scholars and you would see advocates and you would see journalists who were writing about inequality and writing about segregation. But then when it came time to make a decision for their own children, they used their advantage to put their children in heavily white and low poverty schools. So I knew, all right, so let me, okay. It's complicated, right? So I was not a mother, and it's very easy to judge parents when you don't have a kid. And it's very easy to say what you would do when you don't actually have to do it, which is why most people say they believe in integration and equality until they actually have to do it for their own child. So I have a child, and then I move to the most segregated school system in the country, and one that is so vastly unequal, where choosing to put your child in a segregated school, and I know better than most that a lot of times these schools are not providing quality education for children. And now I had a child. But I actually knew I was going to put her in one of those schools, because I think the thing that has always been the most difficult to me is as I write in the piece, yes, inequality is systemic. Yes, it happens up here. But it also happens with every individual decision that parents make. And unfortunately, in the story I wrote about my daughter's school, parents were both fighting systemic measures for equality, because for those of you who don't know the story, I decided to enroll my daughter in a segregated high-poverty school that within a year unbeknownst to me, becomes involved. I didn't know this in advance, was going to become involved in an integration battle in Brooklyn, which of course is like supposed to be the hipster haven of progressiveness. And it was a very ugly battle. And if the funny thing was, they were my daughter's school, which was almost all black, 95% poverty, under-enrolled, as is often the case, and then a mile away was a white school in a majority black and Latino school system, a majority white, very low poverty school that was bursting at the seams. Because as you all know, in a majority black and Latino school district, wherever a handful of white folks go, all the white parents want to get their kids into that one school. So that school was bursting at the seams. The school system decides it needs to rezone, and all hell breaks loose. Right. So all of these parents who are like proud, like public school parents, like love bragging about being in public schools. Well, that's because their public school essentially was a private school. It didn't look like the other public schools. And they would tell you they were saving $25,000 a year by putting their kid in this school because they can get a private, you know, education for no cost. And then they could just give that $25,000 to the PTA, mm-hmm. which they did. I mean, literally, they could raise $1 million on a good year. My daughter's PTA will raise $3,000.
Yeah.
So, but the rezoning, if those parents came, would have immediately turned our school into a half white, half impoverished school. And they fought that too, right? So, parents, I don't even think I'm answering the question now, sorry. So, basically, out of a sense of morality, I decided that I was not going to use my privilege to get my daughter into, I mean, I'm like every parent. I had an integrated educational experience because my parents enrolled me in a busing program, a voluntary desegregation program, and I assumed my daughter would too. But then I ended up in this terribly unequal school system and just couldn't see myself putting her in one of those handful of truly integrated advantage schools. Now, in the piece, I talk about that was kind of news to my husband, who that was not his plan. I mean, in New York, like a lot of these segregated systems, when you're middle class, and it doesn't matter what race you are, like very early on, I mean, when my daughter was two, people were asking us, what are you going to do about her school? You need to think about school. And I know enough to know that my daughter will be okay. Right, whatever she can't get in the school, I can give her. But my husband was very worried about it, and he was a military brat, so he had a very unusual experience for a black child in this country. He never attended a segregated school because he attended base schools, and base schools are integrated. But I knew that I needed to do this because I just felt it was right. And I felt I couldn't be writing all of these stories telling people that this was the right thing to do for children and then not do it myself.
How has this experience been? Najah has been there now for, it's her fourth school year. How has it been? What are some surprises? What were your fears and what are you finding?
I mean, I think, so it always feels weird to say this. I don't care if she goes to Harvard. I mean, I don't feel like the most important thing, I feel like we've gotten to the point where like, the most important thing that parents want is like, how can I get my child into like an Ivy League school? I actually don't care. I want her to go to college. I want her to do well. I want her to be happy. But to me, the most important thing, I wanted her to be a good person. I wanted her to understand. I mean, one of the most uncomfortable things about having the level of financial privilege that I have is wanting her to understand how most people don't live like that. And wanting her to understand that she's very lucky. And what motivated me my whole life was this fear of like struggle. I didn't want to struggle like my parents struggled. And I worry, will she have that same sense of fire? Because I can get her anything within reason. I can't buy her a yacht, but I can get her, you know, anything in reason that she wants. And so I felt it was just really important that she not be separated from her community, that she be a good person. And again, knowing she'll be fine because she has college educated
middle-class parents who have access to a lot of things. So it's been mostly really good. I think my fear are the same fears that any parent who puts their kid in a high poverty school, which is she going to be challenged? All of the things that I write about, lack of resources, not always the best quality teachers, all of those things I worried about. And she's academically doing fine. Not everything has been easy. And I think I talk to parents a lot. There have been, I don't know if I should say this publicly. Which every time you say you don't know if you should say it publicly, don't say that. We know this as reporters,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
let's just say everything is not going smoothly. Her teachers have been great. The school community has been great, but she is in a school with kids. So her school, the tenant zone for her school, is a housing project, and that's it. And then there's a small number of middle class, almost all black parents who come in from outside of the district. This is not just a high poverty school. It's very deeply poor and concentrated poverty. And so we have a lot of kids who have a lot of issues. And we've had to deal with some of those issues in the classroom. But I think that is what I expected, right? I mean, if you go into these schools and they function just like the wealthy white schools that we could put our kids in, segregation wouldn't be a problem. We know that concentration of poverty is not good. We know that... that children who are living in stressed environments, and then you have classrooms full of children living in stressed environments, is not a good thing. So there have been issues, but academically it's been great, socially it's been great, and overall, I kind of want to tell a story, but I don't want the school to look bad. All right, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go for it. I mean, it's so funny, like, journalists always want people to, like, tell us everything, and then we don't want to, like, share shit. So there was an incident where there's a little boy in my daughter's class. He lives across the street in the projects. His mother was killed. He's being raised by a stepmother, and it's just a lot of problems in the home. And so he acts out, understandably. I mean, I have a bad day at work, and my husband doesn't want me to talk to him. So... he lives a hard life. And my daughter came home and she said that he had kicked her. And I don't know if white people get raised the same way, but we were taught, like, you couldn't hit someone, but you could defend yourself, right?
So same here.
I had taught my daughter, never put your hands on anyone, never hit anyone. And so when he kicked her and she comes home and I'm like, well, was a teacher there? She was like, no. And I was like, you know, then I have to give her the talk that you don't have to let anyone hit you. And we talked about it, and I was telling her, like, you know, it's not okay for him to ever put his hands on you, but you have to understand that he's going through a lot, and he's acting out because of the things that he's going through. And my daughter sat there, and we talked about it, and then she said, I want to give him something. And I was like, well, what do you want to give him? And she was like, he loves teddy bears, and he doesn't have one, and I want to give him one of my teddy bears. So I get it was a proud parenting moment, I'm not gonna lie. So she went upstairs and she picks out a teddy bear and she takes it to him to school the next day. And she said, Mom, he was so happy when I gave him that teddy bear. And I thought, that's why she's there. Because
so beautiful.
She, just like her understanding of the world and her compassion for other children who aren't as lucky as her, that's what's important. If she goes to Harvard, great. If she doesn't, I don't care. But I'm hoping that my daughter will be a good person who will then go out into the world and try to make the world a better place, because I haven't put her in a cocoon, because I haven't spent, you know, my days trying to drill into her, you have to, like, suck every advantage that you can. Because that's the problem with advantage. Somebody has to lose. If you can't say you want equality, but then advantage for your own child. Like, those two things are in contradiction to each other. And I think it is a very hard thing for parents to say, I'm not going to do everything I can to advantage my child. It does feel unnatural, but I feel like she's getting a distinct advantage that a lot of parents don't recognize. And I think I wish more of us would understand, because in truth, those kids are smart. Those kids are resilient. They have to work harder than she does. She learns a lot from them. And I think the way that we talk about segregation integration is as if only privileged kids are giving anything, and that the other kids have nothing to offer. And every day in the classroom, I see, and my daughter sees, that they have just as much to offer. And in some ways, they have more.
I just wanted to give folks a heads up that in a few minutes, we're going to open up our panel for questions. And there's a microphone in the back, so please start thinking about questions and lining up behind the microphone. That's a really moving. Thank you for sharing. I did want to say one thing about kicking, and because this is like the most common, you know, I've done every book reading that I've done for Mission High School book around the city. The most common question is safety, fights, and emotional problems. And I'm so grateful, because at this point, other white parents are in the audience, and they're like, "I'm right here. Let me tell you some stories." And I hear these stories, and I actually I just recently met a parent whom I really admire, Sarah Desaran. She, you know, she is that parent that absolutely can afford to send her child to a private school, but opted in for a public school and Mission High School specifically because she felt like her son will gain so much from being in that particular school. And, you know, and I asked her, like, well, how has it been? And, you know, what's the most common question parents ask you? And she's like, the safety thing. I'm like, well, what do you tell them? She said, well, my other kid is in a predominantly white school, low poverty. There's way more fighting there. Way more fighting there, and the girls are so mean. So it's like, it does, it's not like those things, you know, they happen in all schools.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, let me tell you, I was terrorized in these white schools. So I mean, it wasn't a physical, but it was certainly a lot of psychological warfare that happened in those schools. And what's so amazing is, like, people don't, like, these children are very disciplined. Their parents don't play about how you respect adults. You know, I mean, the few white kids in the school, a lot of times the black parents are looking like, wow, you're just going to let your kid run around and talk crazy to, you know. But it is that idea of fear. That is the most common thing that I hear. And when the little boy kicked my daughter, I asked her, I was like, are you afraid of him? Are you afraid? Because no parent wants to feel like your child is afraid. And she said no. And after she came in and she gave him the bear, he's never touched her again. He was having a moment, but he wasn't a bully, and she wasn't afraid, and she was safe. I remember when I wrote the piece, I got all these emails from parents who were like, how dare you put your child in an unsafe school? Never once in the piece, as a matter of fact, I say the school is a very safe school. I never once mentioned safety, but it's an automatic assumption that if it is a black school, and then a poor black school, that these kids, and keep in mind, my daughter's in pre-K. We're talking about babies. But then I think we should always remember the book that I'm writing, The Problem We All Live With, the title of that book comes from the Norman Rockwell painting of Ruby Bridges. And this is a five-year-old who has to be escorted by U.S. Marshals into a white school and then spends the first semester in a classroom by herself with one teacher because every white parent pulled their child out of that school. So we kind of laugh, but this fear of black children begins at a very young age. And this belief that our children are not really children like other children begins at a very young age. And I think that is the biggest thing that we're up against. When people ask why are schools segregated, I think I say it's because people are afraid to put their kids in school with black children. Like, that's it. Fundamentally, that is it. And Latinos, to a lesser extent, But that is the crux of it. And until we get over that, we're actually never going to solve the problem.
It's now time to turn to our audience. Just a quick reminder, if you could keep your questions as short as possible, because we want to get to all of them.
I'll keep my answers shorter.
What's the first question, please?
I'm sort of thinking about the problem we all live with podcasts, and particularly that town hall, and wondering if you can point to any specific like things, tangible or intangible, whether it's mindsets or culture, that have to be in place in order for integration to be implemented well.
So I should just say I'm the least optimistic person on this issue that you will meet. I don't think we're going to solve it. And So the mind state that is necessary is, do you truly believe that Black children are equal to your own? Truly believe that. And I say that because we say we believe that, but then... So, for instance, in New York City, there was a teacher or a principal who decided she was going to try to equalize talented and gifted. Because in many, many places, as you know, talented and gifted, even in an all-Black school, will be all white. That is the way that you create segregation in integrated schools. And so she had placed, it was a majority Black and Latino school, and she ensured that a majority of the kids in talented and gifted were Black and Latino. And when white parents would tour that school, they would say, that can't possibly be talented and gifted. Now, I think most of you may have a similar reaction, if we're honest. I think that many white Americans think that there are exceptional Black people who are very smart and very successful, but they are not representative. And that most white Americans are afraid of putting their kids in a school and a classroom that is majority Black. So until we can address that, we'll never have integration. Because even in integration buildings, so we're in San Francisco, there's a great deal of tracking even in the integrated schools here. I know Berkeley, which of course is like proudly integrated, but the tracking that occurs in Berkeley High School is immense, right? So if we can't deal with that issue, we're never going to have integration. How do we deal with that, though? I don't know. I mean, revolution, start from scratch? I don't know. I don't know. And I'm only half joking. I say that I write about race in America from 1619. And that's because that's the first year that Africans were brought in this country to be enslaved. We land on Jamestown in 1615. Or 14, right? So 5 years after the English have landed in this country, we have already determined that Black people are going to be brought here and enslaved in the bottom of racial caste. That means it is not only foundational to our country, this is 140 years before we become a country. It is in our DNA. How do we rid ourselves of something that is in our DNA? How many of you are comfortable, would be comfortable enrolling your children in a school that was 95% Black? If you're not comfortable with that, then you have to ask yourself why. And if you're not comfortable with that, then you understand that we'll never solve the issue of segregation.
My name's Allie Collins, and I wanted to ask you to talk about organizations like greatschools.com, niche.com, all these kind of web companies that sell school rating systems and end up classifying schools as good schools versus bad schools and support educational redlining in our cities.
What do you want me to say?
Well, I want to, because it's not a conversation that I hear people talking about. It's kind of this, everybody on every playground, you hear parents talking about good schools and bad schools, and it's coded racial
right.
kind of language, and yet everyone's okay with going to great schools and figuring out if it's a 6 or a 10, and you know, progressive cities like this, it's not even a conversation among progressive people that's just another form of redlining.
Yeah. I mean, I think those sites make segregation easy, right? Parents never have to actually say why they're avoiding schools. They go on the website, they look at the test scores, and we can say that we're not going to a school because of the test scores. I think they've done a lot of harm. I think No Child Left Behind has done a lot of harm, right? Because now everyone can just judge a school on test scores when we know test scores largely track to socioeconomics and not to actually how well a school is doing educating children. So I think it's been really problematic. After I did my piece on choosing school for my daughter, I had so many parents, especially white parents, but also some black middle class parents, who said that they wrote schools off without ever stepping a foot in the door. And that when I wrote about like convincing my husband, who also wrote schools off without stepping a foot in the door, I mean, it's hard. Like most of us, we're not educators. We don't know what makes a school good or not. So the only thing that we think we know are test scores. And then what the research also shows is more important than test scores for white people is how white is the school. And that actually they'll go to a lower test score school if it's more heavily white. But it allows us to discount schools without ever having to actually go in the school and see what's happening in the classroom. And once I took my husband in some of these schools, then he was perfectly comfortable enrolling our daughter in the school. So I think they've been really harmful and really detrimental to segregation. But let's be real, the segregation has been here way before the internet, and people have found a way to do it. It's just easier now.
Hi, my name is Nyzena Eberhardt, and I'm all about building black excellence and healing our communities. So my question is, how will we be able to get more African-American parents in our communities involved in the education system and building our communities? And also, what is a good method to healing our broken communities?
To what?
A good method to healing our broken communities.
So when you say get them more involved, what do you mean?
Like, well, I'm APAC, which is African American Parents Advisory Council, and we're all about trying to engage more parents, but we're looking for resources to attract African American parents to be involved in, you know, the education system, be more teacher parent friendly, you know, banning teacher parent relationships. So do you have any good advice on methods that we can be able to use to, you know, gang relationship in the school systems and, you know, as far as community development, you know, like as far as I'm from the Western Addition area. So, you know, a lot has changed in our neighborhood. But now being in Bayview, it's like, you know, it's starting to change, too. So how do we get more of us involved in it?
So, I mean, that's not my area of expertise, but I can just give you a couple of my thoughts. One of the things that I have found is that schools have failed black folks generationally. So because of that, a lot of our black parents don't want to come into the schools. School is not a good experience for them. They don't know how to engage with teachers. They're often talked down to by teachers and principals. And so it can be difficult for them to come into schools. And I think particularly in high poverty schools, which tend to be run in a very regimented way, sometimes authoritarian leadership, sometimes necessarily because the principal feels like they have to control everything in the school, that they can sometimes be unwelcoming places. I think we also, when we look at parent involvement, tend to look at it through the prism of white middle class values, PTA. At my daughter's school, parent participation is often they'll do fundraisers, or they will always come to if there is an event at the school, if there's a talent show at the school, if there's a recital, they come to that. But they're not going to be in school all day because they're not stay-at-home moms. They have jobs. They help with homework, but we don't recognize a lot of that participation because it doesn't manifest in the way that we think it should. So I think having to have schools that are open and welcoming, that don't look and reflect the bad experiences that many parents had, is important. And I think making sure that you understand you can't have a PTA meeting at 10 a.m. You have to have it in the evening. You have to provide child care. You need to provide dinner. We started having our PTA meetings at 6 p.m. We had to provide a meal because parents had to, you know, moms had to bring their kids. They didn't want to be at a meeting until 8 p.m. and then have to feed their kid. They needed child care so they could actually listen. So it's all of these things trying to address the particular needs of the community that I think are important. But again, I'm not an expert on community organizing or engagement, but those are just things as a parent observing my own daughter's school that I've seen. I'm not doing a good job keeping these answers short, am I?
Hi, my name is Linda. And my biggest problem is that I have an Oreo I have Oreo kids, meaning that I have one color and the other one is another color.
Okay.
And I have a lot of problems because every time my Oreo, the other one, the outsider one, go places and go to school, the teachers tends to give him a harder time than they give the cream one. And my biggest problem is that how do you get these teachers in here that really doesn't want to help the African-American kids, but they just want to come get what they need in the Bayview Hunters Point and then run with the credentials and stuff that they take from us. How do we work with this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fundamental issue. And I mean, I don't know what type of school your children go to. Is it a segregated school?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that we know, one, the vast majority of the teaching staff is white, even though our schools are increasingly non-white, and that novice teachers are much more likely to be in high poverty schools, stay a couple years and leave. That's a problem. I think one of the things when I was an education writer that I wrote about was how school systems don't incentivize teachers, veteran teachers, to go into these schools. It's harder. You're penalized all the time when you don't make certain benchmarks. And so a lot of times those teachers don't want to be in those schools and they have no incentive to do it whatsoever. So I think you absolutely need, one, we need to work on diversifying the teaching staff. I think it is so critical that students of all races be taught by teachers of color as well as white teachers. We also need to ensure that there is appropriate training. If you're a white teacher coming out of a middle-class environment and now you're trying to teach a bunch of black and brown kids, and what the research has shown is that white teachers actually do not think that black children are as high-achieving or as capable, and that then reflects in how they're instructing those children. So I think we have to address that head-on with training, with competency training. And I hate things like cultural competency because I think when we say those words, people kind of roll their eyes, but it actually does matter. You actually do need to understand the communities that you're teaching in, and I don't think we get nearly enough. I don't think we take it seriously.
So San Francisco has a history of segregated schools and also of a tiny number of schools kind of being gentrified by white families who kind of Columbus really, you know, good schools that are actually serving low-income kids and are in danger of being closed. And then in a sort of school generation of 7 years, remake that school to the point that it's one of the whitest schools in the city and is no longer serving kids of color. So as obviously we need kind of systemic solutions, but as a white person who's one of 3% of white families in my school and who's also thinking about those systemic solutions, how do we avoid remaking integrated schools to the point that they're damaging families like we've heard tonight?
Absolutely. Here's the thing. Segregation was not accidental nor incidental. It was planned. It was strategized. There were lots of resources put into it. Integration has to be done the same way. We have to think about it. We have to plan for it. We have to strategize around it. We have to put resources into it. So the way that integration tends to happen now is just that way. White parents pick a school, then other white parents follow, but it's actually not part of a larger strategy in the district to integrate schools. So because of that, those schools very quickly flip. You need a system-wide, you need people at the system-wide level who are thinking about integrating not just a handful of schools, but all of the schools. The problem is parents fight this, right? That's the problem. I mean, school administrators know that integration is good for kids. The reason they're not pushing it is because politically it's bad for them. So until you have enough white people in a community who are saying, as a system, this is our value and this is what we're going to do, it's not going to happen. And what will happen is what will likely happen at the school your kid is at, what we're worried is going to happen at the school our kid is at, which is that the school is going to flip. And almost always, these are schools that the only reason that white parents go into them is because they're serving those kids well. They're high functioning. White parents are not going into like crappy segregated schools. They're going into the segregated schools that are working. And then, so this handful of high quality segregated schools get lost to that community too, which is very problematic. So I think that the solution cannot be at an individual school. The solution has to be system-wide. But there are some things that can be done. Controlled choice is one thing that they try to use in New York, which is where you set aside a certain number of seats. Usually they do for low-income kids because they're afraid of the Supreme Court if they use race. in order to keep a school from flipping all of the way. But again, I think these issues are not, these are not individual issues. These are systemic issues and they require systemic solutions. But where's the groundswell? And I think this is getting back to the Charlottesville thing, mm-hmm. right? It's like, where's the groundswell of support around integration? Where are all the parents and people who will run downtown and march against white supremacy while upholding white supremacy in their school district every day? If you could see that level of support, then I promise you, school leaders would react and respond to that. They're responding to what they think white parents want and what white parents do want, which is a system that continues to privilege their children.
I just wanted to say we have time for two more questions, but after this program, we're all going to head out to the bar. So please don't worry. We can address these questions after the program.
I'm sure after this uplifting talk, you guys will all want a few drinks.
In my experience, there can be a difference between a diverse school and an integrated school. Uh-huh. And I'm curious if you have any advice for how a school that has the potential to be an amazing integrated school can create a community that is integrated.
Yeah. I mean, one, let me just say it's hard. It's going to be hard. Even in my daughter's school, where the integration that has occurred is only class, I mean, everybody in the school is Black, even that has been hard. And we're all the same race. So I think that, again, it has to be intentional. It can't be that white and middle-class parents come into a school and the same power dynamic that gives them privilege they wield in those schools. That immediately they take over all the governance of the school. They want to determine how everything is run. They know that everything that's best about what should be done in that school. I think that power sharing is very important. I know the integration has to be down to the classroom. It cannot be white kids in a building in their own classes. It has to be to the classroom level. When white parents decided they were going to maybe try to come into our daughter's school, they demanded of the principal that all their children be put in the classroom together. And when the principal said no, they did not come. So I think that power sharing is important. The trying to understand the culture of the school and not change the culture of the school, but not also feeling like you can't provide anything for the school, because of course you can. It's how do you build, because integration is about the sharing of power and the sharing of values. And everyone's going to have to give up a little bit, but the people who've always had to give up the most should not be giving up the most in that circumstance. And I think it's very hard for people who are used to people listening to what they say and people bowing to their authority to give some of that up, and to also respect the knowledge and the skills and the passion that the parents who are already in those communities bring. And I think that's a very hard thing to do. People want integration to just be this like beautiful kumbaya thing. It's not. I mean, we have a lot of history and it's hard to overcome, but I think those of us who really think that we can and we should are going to have to be willing to be uncomfortable to make it happen. And I'll say going into this school, I mean, has been humbling for me, because I thought it would be a lot easier to build relationship with the lower income parents, Black parents in the school, because we're all Black. And it wasn't. It was still a challenge. Just the class barriers were still a challenge, but we haven't been willing to give up, and we tried very hard to be humble in that situation. I think that's the biggest thing that white parents who go into these schools need to understand, is that humility is necessary.
And I'm sorry, we have time for just one more question.
Okay, great. I guess it's me. Hi, so grateful and impressed and happy to be here. My name is Marche. I'm with the Black Organizing Project in Oakland. And something that we've been fighting for many years is the removal of school police in Oakland. And we've been pushing this discussion statewide and nationally. So my question to you today is, do you see a large presence of police in the school that your daughter's at, even after the segregation? And like, what kind of impact does that have on the school, the family, the communities in that, you know, within that school? And what do you see as kind of a solution if the police are in your school? So if they're in the school, and then kind of how that's impacting families.
So my daughter, she's in elementary school, so we don't have a big police presence. Every New York City public school has a officer at the front door. That's just every school. Other than that, and she's great and everybody loves her. at my daughter's school. But police in New York City schools, particularly the high schools and middle schools, well, police in Black and Latino schools in the city are very, very problematic. And they, what's unusual about New York City is there is a, in the New York NYPD, there is a department that puts, there's a department specifically of school police that only answers the NYPD. So they can actually come into, they can arrest students over the objection of principals. They don't answer to the Department of Education. And we see very high arrest rates of students, often for things that the principals, like they're not even infractions. We, most of the metal detectors are in Black schools, Black and Latino schools. So I think that you build a school like a prison, kids are gonna act like prisoners, right? But again, it comes from that fear and that inability for us to see them as children. And I think it's very problematic. Luckily, in my daughter's school, that's not an issue. But it, I know as we get ready in a few years to start thinking about middle school and then high school, that that's going to be a huge problem.
Thank you, Marsha. Nicole, you might know this. This is a last question, and it's an informed tradition that you might have heard about, but we ask all of our speakers to give us their 60-second idea for changing the world.
Damn. can I have 60 seconds to think about it?
Absolutely.
To change the world. You know, I just don't think we're going to change. So that's so hard. I think if each one of us decided to give up one advantage for the good of our community, that could make a huge difference.
That would be huge.
So, yeah. But my real 60-second idea is like actually like live your own values. Actually live your values. And it's not easy. But if you really believe in equality, that's what you have to do.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you for modeling that for all of us. And thank you for traveling.
Two glasses of water.
Well, let's continue over the drinks.
All right, cool.